This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus. The U.S. said Sunday it expects that China will retaliate with increased tariffs on U.S. exports after President Donald Trump sharply boosted levies on Chinese products headed to the United States. Trade talks between the two economic superpowers have been going on in Beijing and Washington for months, but they recessed again in the U.S. Capitol on Friday without a deal being reached. Chief White House economic adviser Larry Kudlow told Fox News Sunday that while he remains optimistic about an eventual deal, many long-standing issues remain.
We don't think the Chinese have come far enough. We'll wait and see. The talks will continue. And I will say this, there's a G20 meeting in Japan toward the end of June next month. The chances that President Trump and President Xi will get together at that meeting are probably pretty good.
He said both sides will suffer from the escalating trade war between the world's two biggest economies. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo meets with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov this week as the two countries clash over a number of issues, including Venezuela, Iran, and Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. Pompeo heads to Moscow Sunday in his first visit to Russia as chief U.S. diplomat. Officials in Pakistan say the death toll from the overnight militant raid on a luxury hotel near the China-run strategic port of Gwadar has risen to at least five, and security forces have completed clearance operations at the Pearl Continental Hotel, killing all three terrorists who participated in the attack Saturday. The separatist Baluchistan Liberation Army claimed responsibility for the attack on the heavily guarded hotel. Prime Minister Imran Khan denounced it as part of efforts to sabotage Chinese-funded economic projects in Pakistan. This is VOA News. Gunmen killed six people attending Mass at the Catholic Church of Dablo in northern Burkina Faso Sunday morning, officials and witnesses said. The priest and five churchgoers were among the victims, a witness told VOA Africa. Last week, gunmen killed five people in a Protestant church in the small northern town of Silgaji. The Roman Catholic faithful in Sri Lanka's capital attended Mass Sunday for the first time since the Easter bombings of churches and hotels that killed more than 250 people. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for those attacks. Officials say all of the jihadists responsible for the attacks have been arrested or killed, but the prime minister warned that the country is still threatened by global terrorism. He told Parliament the Buddhist-majority country needs more international help to prevent future attacks. Eight countries, including the U.S., are already participating in the Sri Lankan-led investigation. Democrats are stepping up their investigations of President Donald Trump, as Republicans say it's time to move on, AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Several House committees have issued subpoenas related to the Mueller report on the Russia investigation, President Trump's business dealings, and years of his tax returns. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Democrat Adam Schiff tells ABC's This Week the Trump administration is trying to obstruct Congress with its blanket refusal to cooperate.
They know that vast categories are inapplicable to the privilege here, so they're just stonewalling.
House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy tells CBS Face the Nation Democrats seem fixated on subpoenas rather than addressing the country's needs.
We want to move forward. We got health care. We got trade. We got a crisis on our border.
Tim McGuire, Washington.
Afghan officials are downplaying the significance of the United States diverting funds from its military mission in Afghanistan as a senior American diplomat arrives in Kabul for high-level discussions. Acting U.S. Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan on Friday approved the transfer of $1.5 billion to build barriers on the border with Mexico, including taking more than $600 million designated for beleaguered Afghan security forces, which are struggling to contain Taliban battlefield advances. Afghanistan's interior minister told reporters that Washington remains committed to supporting Afghan security forces and emphasized it is an internal U.S. policy matter as to how and where they want to spend their money. 40 U.S. states have filed a lawsuit against 20 pharmaceutical companies that make generic drugs, accusing the companies of participating in a scheme to inflate drug prices, sometimes by much as 100% by 1,000%. The five-page lawsuit seeks action to restore competition to the generic drug market. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Leadership bodies, responsibilities, to observe and make the indefinite decisions about the future of the countries and future of negotiations and formation of civil government.
The Sudanese Military Council and the opposition coalition to resume talks Monday.
Each and every political party or independent candidate have been submitting names of their monitors who will monitor these elections. As we are standing now, we are in the process of issuing these accreditations, and it should be done before Pori.
Malawian Electoral Commission to receive ballot papers to be used for the upcoming elections Monday.
Well, the Prime Minister has come to the field. Other people will be talking to him, because if he's just Prundi talking, they'll think that Prundi is a politician and he wants to win the debate on his side. But he's on the field listening to even the old people and the other shades of opinion.
And the Cameroonian main opposition party outlines proposals to end the ongoing crisis. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Sudanese opposition coalition has agreed with the Transitional Military Council to resume negotiations Monday. The talks stalled over disagreements about the opposition coalition's suggestions for the military council to hand over power. The military council said the demand shows the lack of seriousness from the opposition. For more on Monday's meeting, I reached Dr. Mohamed Al-Ansari, a leading member of the Sudanese opposition UMA party, which is part of the opposition coalition.
Declaration of Freedom and Change and military councils are resuming negotiation, which is like being distracted for a few times. The military council trying to create consensus of bringing so many political parties to these dialogues, and also mobilizing the parties that participated with the previous regime, which we consider it very wrong for military councils to bring the partners of previous regimes or people participated in the previous governments to those negotiations. And also one of the critical mistakes that military council did, which treated all these political parties on the same way, which is wrong as well.
The military council has on occasion accused the opposition of coming up with different views according to the negotiation delegation. So you are changing the terms of the negotiations in the middle of the script, which doesn't go well with them.
So as the Declaration of Freedom and Change, we have not changed the terms and conditions of the negotiation. We have been stick to the points that it has been highlighted in Declaration of Freedom and Change, and we have been stick of developing that concepts to a genuine transition period, which all political parties sign Declaration of Freedom and Change to be part of that era. And we also identify the transition period should be 4 years. We believe that 4 years is quite enough for political parties to prepare themselves to fair democratic change. For this, but the military council has been dealing with so many political parties are not part of this agenda. For this, they are reflecting to media. The political parties in Sudan are coming with different views and different agendas.
What about a written response to the military council on regarding the draft constitutional document? Have you agreed on the way forward regarding the constitutional draft document?
Yes, we agreed in the majority of the content that it has been highlighted in the draft constitutional. But we still have some points that still we need to agree on and identify which is the best way to take this forward. For this, the constitutional, like some part of it, yes, still we have not agreed on it. But the majority of it, for example, the form of the government, the types of participations, the way of dealing with foreign countries or the external relation of or the foreign relation of the of Sudan, like the different part of participation in the jurisdictions law. So there are different things. It has been agreed.
Briefly talk to me about the formation of a leadership body of the opposition coalition that will meet the military council to determine all these.
Yes, we agreed now to have the leadership body. It has been agreed that it has specific responsibilities. For example, if the negotiation it has been distracted for any reason, we have to go back to the leadership council or leadership body to identify and find a way forward of this disagreement. Also, in any agreement, also we have to go back to this leadership body to approve what it has been agreed and how we can implement what we have been agreed on. The third thing, the leadership body's responsibilities to observe and make the indefinite decisions about the future of the countries and future of negotiations and formation of civil government, formation of also of other part of councils that will lead the transition period.
Dr. Mohamed Al Ansari is a leading member of the Sudanese opposition Umma Party. He spoke with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Malawi Electoral Commission expects to receive ballot papers on Monday and Tuesday for the May 21 polls. Officials of the electoral body say ballot papers for the parliamentary and local government elections will be first to arrive on Monday, while those of the presidential vote will arrive on Tuesday. They said political party representatives, civil society groups, and other stakeholders have been invited to the Kamuzu International Airport in the capital Lilongwe when the Electoral Commission receives the ballot papers. The move is meant to ensure transparency. For the latest development before the polls, I read Sangwani Mwafulirwa, spokesperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission.
Well, as we are preparing for the elections on May 21, we were printing ballot papers in Dubai. They are coming into the country. So what we have done as Malawi Electoral Commission is to increase the transparency around the logistics to do with ballot papers. We have informed all political parties in advance the time and the date, and including the airport where the ballot papers will be received. So we are receiving them in Lilongwe, which is in the center of the country. When we receive them on the 13th and 14th, the ballot papers will not be moved, will be kept at a secure warehouse within the airport. We'll wait until 16th, and on 16th we'll be dispatching them to the councils. So for the receiving of the ballot papers, we have invited all political parties.
So the Malawi Electoral Commission is basically bolstering its transparency by inviting stakeholders, including the political party representatives, to be at the airport as you receive these ballot papers, correct?
Yes, they will be witnessing. As each and every ballot is being taken from the airport to the warehouse, they will be allowed to record the serial number of each and every ballot, so that they can also check on the day of dispatch. We don't want them somebody to say some ballot papers are missing or they are, we cannot account for them. We just want to be as transparent as we can.
So, Sangwani, I also understand the Malawi Electoral Commission has compiled a list of presidential candidates. So far, how many people have qualified to represent their respective parties as well as stand as independent?
Well, I can start by giving a background that only from 4th to 8th April, Malawi Electoral Commission was receiving nomination papers from candidates. Now, we got nomination papers from about 20 candidates. Some of them were rejected because they never made the criteria. Out of these teams, one dropped out on her own volition. If it drew from the rest, despite meeting all the nomination criteria, then another one was disqualified because they never provided the missing details. And the rested one has been disqualified because of a court ruling. The candidate did not get the nomination sanctioned by the party. So the court ruled that the candidate should be disqualified, and we did that. So as we stand today regarding the presidential race, we have 7 candidates. I should mention that out of these 7 candidates, all of them are male, and there is no woman who is a running mate.
So talk to me about the latest development regarding the preparation level of the Electoral Commission to organize the upcoming May 21 elections.
We are advanced if you compare with the logistics, how we are progressing in 2014. We are on schedule. Recruitment of all polling staff is being done. We have trained them. We have tested our result transmission system. It's working perfectly. And this Monday, we are running a secondary dry test just to ensure that all the roof ends have been tightened ready for the transmission after polling. I should also mention that in Malawi, you've got a law that official campaign ends 48 hours to polling. Now, since the polling is on 21st May, it means all the campaign activities will stop at 6 a.m. on the 19th of May.
So far, how has the campaigns been going on? Because there were suspicion of attacks and politically related violence and all that. Tell me about monitoring these campaigns ahead of the elections.
Well, I can say that the campaign for this year's election has been making that there has been intense rallies conducted by political parties that are campaigning. So many rallies have been held. Most of them have ended peacefully. However, the challenge is that if one rally has an incidence of violence, it tends to blot out the achievements of other peaceful rallies. So we should commend the politicians in Malawi for maintaining law, peace and order during this campaign. The democracy of Malawi is maturing.
What about both local and foreign observers who will come to monitor the election?
Well, we have a number of missions that are already in. We got the SADC, we got the Commonwealth, we got the African Union, and so many international organizations that are coming to observe these elections. But on that one, I should also be quick to say each and every political party or independent candidate have been submitting names of their monitors who will monitor these elections. As we are standing now, we are in the process of issuing these accreditations, and it should be done before polling.
Sangwani Mwafulerwa is the spokesperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The South African Independent Electoral Commission says it is pleased with the conduct and management of the just-ended polls. The election saw the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, as the declared winner with 58% of the parliamentary election, an outcome which is seen as the party's worst performance since the end of apartheid. The Democratic Alliance, or DA, followed with 21%, while Julius Malema's Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, coming in a distant third with 11% of the total vote cast. For more about the elections, I reach Mawethu Mosri, the Deputy Chief Electoral Officer of the South African Independent Electoral Commission.
Indeed, the Electoral Commission of South Africa is satisfied with the management of the election process as well as conclusion of this election process. Even more satisfied with the political stability that we have in the country for these elections. So overall, we have a high level of satisfaction with how we manage this particular sixth general election of South Africa. But more so, it's confirmed by an opinion survey that was conducted during the voting day and post-voting day by an independent authority in this country, which is the Human Sciences Research Council, which gave us a score of 97% overall satisfaction of voters with the electoral process.
That means there are approximately 3% that you could improve upon in administering elections in South Africa. What specifically do you think needs to be improved upon ahead of the next election that the IEC would organize?
Oh, yes. The 3% was actually indifferent. They were not sure whether we did badly or we did very well. They were just indifferent. And therefore, we always have to look at things that we could do differently in every election experience. And certainly this election has given us a number of lessons that we will take forward to future elections. And one of those relates to our logistics, and the other relates on how we manage political parties and political party candidates. And lastly, also how we ensure that civic education is always at the top of our agenda and at the top of our programs as a country.
If a political party is displeased with the outcome of election, what recourse do they have and what time frame does that particular party have in order to address some of these concerns they have?
Well, the recourse is twofold. The first one is obviously to lodge an objection with the Electoral Commission within 2 days after voting, which all political parties had until Friday at 1700 to lodge those objections. But prior to that, on voting day itself, we allowed political parties during the voting process to raise issues of concerns, complaints, and ask for intervention, so that we can correct any anomalies during the voting process. So that's the first area that parties could utilize around the election. The second level is obviously to approach the courts in the country, but the sense of our legal framework and our procedural framework is that you must exhaust interaction with the Electoral Commission before you go to the courts and approach the courts for an order or a declaratory order or an order defining and determining how your disputed issues should be dealt with. So we've been advising political parties. Indeed, we dealt with our own objections. There were about 150 of them, and we determined them on Friday before the announcement of the final.
On social media platforms, there were videos of a drunkard trying to vote and collapsing. And then there was also a polling station officer who was carrying the ballot papers without the presence of security. When you hear some of these issues, how do you address them?
Well, we're quite aware of the various videos that made rounds. There were many positive ones as well about how well the stations were laid out and how well they were operating. On the few ones that you've mentioned, some of the activities in those videos were perfectly correct in terms of our framework. There was nothing amiss. However, the person who shot the video may have shot it with a particular angle into what was taking place in that venue. So it is very difficult to comment in a very direct and clear way. And the last one of an overly over-intoxicated individual, it started to circulate the day after election. We were not aware of it.
Mowethu Mosri is the Deputy Chief Electoral Officer of the South African Independent Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. In Cameroon, the main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, has presented a four-point proposal to end the ongoing crisis in the English parts of the country. This after the leaders of the SDF met with Prime Minister Joseph Nguti, who was visiting Bamenda to consult citizens in the Anglophone regions. It came after the Prime Minister said President Paul Biya was now ready for a formal dialogue to end the ongoing conflict. For more about the peace proposal, I read John Fruin, the leader of the Cameroonian main opposition party, Social Democratic Front, or SDF.
we said that for these things to move on, the SDF made a four-point proposal. One, the immediate bilateral ceasefire from both sides. The second point was that we said there should be immediate release of all prisoners of war. The third point was that we want a mediator, somebody who can talk to both government and maybe have the courage to penetrate the boys in the bush. And they were making a proposal that I should be the one, but I don't know how that would be. And we also said they should have a structure for the dialogue. And this dialogue, when it comes out with the resolutions should be binding with force of the law. We said no elections in Northwest, Southwest under this present conditions. And we told them that the time is urgent and the government has to do something immediately.
Now, Mr. Fruindi, this is not the first time the issue of Anglophones have come to the attention of President Paul Biya. In actual fact, former President Ahidjo appointed him to handle issues of concerns of the Anglophones earlier on. So what do you think this proposal will do? Looking at what is happening now, these are not new to him.
Yes, things are not new to him. But what is new to him is the way the young people that do not know the history of Cameroon and what Ahidjo did, and those that have not gone through the old good days to have the bite or the touch of what we are talking about, have taken up arms to say that we want to be ourselves. I think that this should teach Mr. Biya a lesson, because I think that Mr. Biya thought that with time, all the old people will die off and the children and grandchildren coming up will not have an idea of what they went through and will not be able to ask for their own rights in the country to have fair treatment, fair judgment, fair share of the jobs and all the likes.
The Prime Minister made a point to say that President Paul Biya was ready for a formal dialogue to resolve the crisis. But some Cameroonians that I spoke with are saying that how genuine is this dialogue, because through the communication minister has been saying dialogue and CPDM, dialogue has been ongoing for some time. So how genuine is the dialogue, if I may ask you, when you spoke with the Prime Minister?
Yes, that's why we held the people down to task and asked them, as the Prime Minister, to give us the guarantees that this time all that is proposing will work, because the former Prime Minister, Philemon Yang, came here, had a good meeting with the teachers and the lawyers, and they had very good proposals that Mr. Biya was supposed just to sign. But we found ourselves in a situation where they instead turned to arrest the people. So we asked the Prime Minister, what are the guarantees that what he's talking now that will bind? Or are we just in a talk shop to talk and... we've heard we are going to report that back to Sabia. Are you just taking us to another talk shop, or you are now talking with meaning and advancing towards solutions?
And what was his reaction?
Well, he said Mr. Sabia for now is very calm and very, he's already understood, and that's why he sent him out with this specific, instructions.
Now, talking about specificity, the Prime Minister also said the President is ready for talks that could cover all subjects except the partition of Cameroon. But how can you have a genuine dialogue if you are putting preconditions on the table?
After going through what we've gone through, if they want to talk, let us start somewhere talking. Then we'll argue those points later.
So after the meeting, what did you tell your people?
Well, the reactions are always the same that, I mean, they know and they're convinced that we are presenting the issues well with all honesty and all genuineness. So if we have to work, as I said before, we have to start somewhere. And if Mr. Biya says he wants to talk, let us sit down and listen to him for the first, if he would give in to that. Because we've heard this, Mr. Biya wants to talk, he wants to do this before. Let us sit down and listen to him.
But with your interaction with him, are you seeing any sort of seriousness? Because as you said earlier on, this is not the first time the president has said he's ready to talk, yet it becomes a talk shop and nothing comes out of it. How different is this from your interaction with the Prime Minister?
Well, the Prime Minister has come to the field. Other people will be talking to him, because if it's just Fruindi talking, they'll think that Fruindi is a politician and he wants to win the debate on his side. But he's on the field listening to even the old people and the other shades of opinion.
John Fruindi is the leader of the Cameroonian main opposition party, Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from Bamenda. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impoga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, dementia is a rapidly growing public health problem everywhere in the world. 50 million people suffer from dementia, and in the next 30 years, that number is expected to triple. Researchers are looking for ways to treat or prevent dementia. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us about a promising clinical trial underway in the U.S.
Regular exercise, a healthy diet, maintaining healthy blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar levels help stave off dementia as we grow older. Dementia is not a normal part of aging, but age is a huge risk factor. As people around the world live longer, health agencies and researchers are looking for ways to prevent, stop, or treat dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, one of the most common types of dementia. David Shore is about to undergo a new procedure that could treat early-stage Alzheimer's. He's with his doctor, Vipor Krishna, a neurosurgeon at Ohio State Wexner Medical Center.
Let's do it.
The procedure Shore is about to have involves sound waves. Ultrasound waves target and open the blood-brain barrier, a protective layer that shields the brain from infections. But Krishna says the barrier also makes it hard to treat neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's.
Opening the blood-brain barrier allows us to access more of the brain tissue and be able to increase the effectiveness or bioavailability of the therapeutics.
Shore and his wife Kim were willing to try any new treatment that might help with his dementia. Kim describes the couple's reaction when they received a phone call inviting Shore to participate in a clinical trial.
There's this trial, would you be interested? And without really knowing what it was, we said sure.
Shore became one of 10 patients enrolled in the study. The trial tests MRI-guided imaging to target the part of the brain responsible for memory and cognition. Krishna explains that's where Alzheimer's patients have a buildup of toxic proteins called amyloid.
Higher deposition of amyloid goes hand in hand with loss of function in Alzheimer's disease.
Krishna says this procedure might allow a patient's own immune system to clear some of the amyloid. In the procedure, ultrasound wave pulses cause microscopic bubbles to expand and contract in the brain.
The increase and decrease in size of these microbubbles mechanically opens the blood-brain barrier.
The patient is awake during the procedure.
First treatment, David. Here we go.
This area has high amyloid. So we'll be opening this area.
Opening the barrier may one day allow doctors to deliver medication straight to the site of the disease. Kim Shore realizes her husband might not benefit from this treatment.
We're hopeful that it can help him, but we also know maybe it'll help somebody else.
Shore was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at age 56. He's glad to be part of a study that could help others who are in the early stages of Alzheimer's, even if it doesn't help him. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impoga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. All is set for the African Confederation Cup final. Renaissance Berkane of Morocco and Zamalek of Egypt reached this year's African Confederation Cup final after securing aggregate wins over Tunisian clubs CX Sfaxienne and Etoile du Sahel. Berkane will host the first leg of the final in Morocco on May 19th. With a return match in Egypt 7 days later. It will be Renaissance Berkane's first appearance in an African final, whilst Egyptian giant Zamalek will be hoping to end a 16-year African trophy drought. If Bakane win, they will become the fifth Moroccan winners of the Confederation Cup after FAR Rabat in 2005, FUS Rabat in 2010, MS FES in 2011, and Raja Casablanca in 2018. Meanwhile, Esperance of Tunisia and Wydad Casablanca of Morocco also qualified for the CAF Champions League, setting up a third consecutive title decider between North African clubs. Trophy holders Esperance drew 0-0 away to TP Mazembe of the DR Congo in a semi-final second leg to advance 1-0 on aggregate. Wydad proved equally strong defensively to force a goalless stalemate away to Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa and progressed 2-1 overall. It will be the second Champions League final between Esperance and Wydad, with the Tunisians winning 1-0 on aggregate in 2011. In the previous two finals, Wydad and Esperance defeated record eight-time African champions Al Ahly of Egypt in an all-North African affair. Wydad will host Esperance on May 24th or 25th, with the return match on May 31st or June 1st, and the champions will take home $2.5 million. If Esperance win, they will become the first back-to-back winners of the Elite Africa Club competition since Ahly in 2012 and 2013. The Tunis outfit, who celebrated their 100th birthday 4 months ago, have reached the final by winning 7 matches, a drawing 3, scoring 16 goals and conceding only 5. Talking of continental championships, it's an all-English UEFA Champions League final this season. This historic feat was made possible by the enormous contributions of 6 African players who led Liverpool and Tottenham to the finals to be played in Madrid on June 1st. Liverpool have 4 players in their ranks. Guinean midfielder Naby Keita might become the first player for his country to win the trophy, though he'll be in the stands due to injury, just like Senegal's Sadio Mane and Egypt's Mohamed Salah. Joel Matip will be the third Cameroonian to do so, after Jeremy Njitap, who won the trophy twice in 2000 and 2002 with Real Madrid, and Samuel Eto'o with 3 trophies, 2 with FS Barcelona and 1 with Inter Milan. For Tottenham, Ivorian defender Segi Aurier could join Didier Drogba, Yaya Toure and Solomon Kalou in the special club of Ivorian UEFA Champions League winners, while for Victor Wanyama, he'll be the second Kenyan to achieve the feat, with the only other Kenyan player to do so being his brother, McDonald Maringa. Another player with African roots in this year's final will be Dovich Origi, whose brace against Barcelona on Tuesday night helped propel his side into the finals. The striker's father is a former Kenyan international footballer. The feat has also earned the Belgian striker a contract extension at Anfield, according to the Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp. One thing is certain, at least 2 Africans will win this year's UEFA Champions League. In the Europa League, Pierre Aubameyang was on a hat-trick as Arsenal beat Valencia at 4-2 in Spain to qualify for this year's final. Finally, in athletics, Seiko and the IAAF announced the renewal of their long-standing partnership for a further 10 years until the end of 2029. Seiko will provide its state-of-the-art timing and measurement services to all 37 World Athletics Series events during the period, including 5 World Athletics Championships. It all started at the 1985 World Indoor Games in Paris, when Seiko was chosen to provide the timing and distance measurement services. Over the subsequent 34 years, Seiko has served at 184 IAAF events, including 15 World Championships, and is now finalizing its plans for the 2019 edition in Doha this September. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. And you are hearing from Yamoto Band with Mama. It will be followed by Amanda Black with Buyela Kum. And then we end with Cheb Khaled with Didi.
nikeshe wakati kesha na bidini ene shule usiku kifika likuwa kifosi mwanao minilale utaki nikeshe wakati kesha na bidini ene shule mama uligomba na majirani. Uishi nisije potea njia na nafurahia najivunia uwepo wako we kwenye dunia na kuombea miaka 100 uishi nisije potea njia mama sabu alo ni baba yako miezi 9 umekaa tumboni mwangu furaha yangu kukuona machoni mwangu kila kukicha namuomba Mungu kila kukicha akulinde mwanangu.
Mama, nimekosea wapi na nataka mimi nijue.
was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. But for minor auditing, the election results in South Africa is clear. The Electoral Commission has assured the public that the results of the minor auditing could not in any way change materially the results posted so far. According to the 99% result posted, this would be the worst performance of the African National Congress, ANC, in South African elections since the end of apartheid in 1994. According to the counts, the ANC may get not more than 57% of the vote, perhaps 57.7% of the vote. This is a poor showing for the ANC. It means that the change of leadership from Jacob Zuma to President Ramaphosa has changed nothing. It may also be recalled that political analysts in South Africa have assured us that for President Ramaphosa to be effectively in control of the ANC, the ANC must have at least 60% of the vote. In fact, under President Zuma in 2014, the ANC obtained 62% of the vote. Now, under Ramaphosa, it is what is said, about 57.7% of the vote. The other important factor of the result is that the Democratic Alliance Opposition Party, DA, also lost votes. This may be due to the fact that a new party of right-wing white leadership gained some seats in the new parliament. And also, the former leader of the DA, Lili, who was expelled, formed a party called the Good, and that party has gained at least one seat the parliament, which means that it took also seat from the DA. So the DA also lost some showing. The only party that gained measurably in this election is the Economic Freedom Fighter Party of Julius Malema. The party almost doubled its support in parliament, perhaps from 6 to about 10 to 11% of the electorate. And this is ironic because Julius Malema was once the leader of the youth section of the ANC. He was expelled from the ANC because of disputes with the leadership. And that decision by the ANC to expel Malema was hailed in the corporate South African media and also in some of the Western media, believing that he was divisive, and some even called him a racist. Malema's party has really resonated with the South African black population. It had called for radical change in the land issue, which means they want land to be seized from the whites, minority who own about 90% of the land without compensation. They have called for the nationalization of the mining industry, and they have been insistent that the gap between the white minority and the black in the economic status must be reduced. South Africa today is one of the most disparity economically between the population. The factor now facing many of the political class in South Africa is whether the ANC will reach out to the economic freedom fighters. This may be very difficult owing to the bitterness between Julius Malema and the leadership of the ANC. Secondly, we have to note what will be the power balance between the executive committee of the ANC between supporters of Ramaphosa and that of Jacob Zuma. These issues have to be resolved. A major question then would have to be, what should be the main focus of the ANC and the opposition? Are they going to continue to fight only on the issue of corruption and state capture, which seems not to have been very effective in this election? These are some of the issues which needs to be settled before we can know what direction South Africa will take in the next few years. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Shao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, everybody joins to blame or condemn a child who overthrows the pot of soup. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.